Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Trust Company quarterly investment call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero. I would now like to hand your conference over to your speaker today, Mr. Wes McCain. Thank you, sir. You may go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Daphne, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining here at the Naples Trust Company quarterly investment call. As a reminder, information presented is for educational purposes only. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. I'm Wes McCann. I'm the president of the Naples Trust Company, and I'm joined today by Ian Bruce, the Trust Company's chief investment officer, and Tim Vick, director of research. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello, Wes.
Good afternoon, Wes.
All right. Well, we've got a lot of questions to cover over the next 30 minutes, so let's get started. Ian, the market seems to have gotten its legs back after the initial coronavirus scare. First question is, how are you assessing the impact of the virus, and is it really an issue for investors, or is it one of those events that just passes through the system quickly?
Well, I think, just looking at the numbers from the World Health Organization, this is still very much a China story. China accounts for about 99% of all cases still. But let's also acknowledge that China is the world's second largest economy. So there will be an economic impact globally, probably this year. And that was highlighted today when Apple came out and revised guidance a little lower on the back of what's going on in China. So we do expect this to show up in earnings in subsequent quarters. And I'd just like to draw the distinction. It's not the actual disease itself that's going to cause the economy to slow, but rather countries trying to contain this new strain of respiratory illness. It's really that containment effort that's going to have an economic impact. But with that all said, we do see this as a very transitory issue. This will come and go like every other geopolitical issue that crops up over time.
Okay, so Tim, we've seen other events that were, large events like this in the past. There were SARS in 2003, Ebola outbreaks in Central Africa, terrorist attacks in Europe and the Middle East. The market quickly reacted, then processed the information and stabilized. How should investors react when these types of outlying events become news?
I think when these events cross our desk and we have to think about them, the first thing that comes to mind is dysfunction is the rule. It's not the exception. And that should always be on the tips of tongues of investors, that there's always going to be some outlying event somewhere around the world, whether it's geopolitical, whether it's a weather event, whether it's a health scare or some economic scare of some point. It's going to be the rule that these things are going to, absorb the news. And, of course, you overlay that with the fact that we have 24-hour news that is going to put these events squarely in your face, for several days and make it seem like it's the most critical thing you need to think about. And you layer on top of that the fact that you have several trillion dollars now of money that is run by computer algorithms, where the computer is just going to, on its own, push a button and see a virus outbreak headline and instantly sell 5% of a portfolio stock and buy those stocks back when that headline disappears. I mean, it's a perfect cocktail for this kind of fear-mongering. And, to Ian's point, if you put the things in perspective and do what we, always apply here in the office, do the math and figure out whether something is going to be a sustainable crisis, that we have to deal with. As Ian already said, this is an issue that's contained in China. It seems to be no better, no worse having of an impact as our own flu virus here, which, by the way, has killed many thousands more than this coronavirus has at this point. And our flu virus just runs through our, economy once a year, during season, and it never really has a long-term impact on our economy. Certainly can disrupt, some pockets of our economy from time to time, but we get through it. I think in the same vein, when we do the math, we see this as something that, can and will be contained by the Chinese, if not other authorities, and we'll just move on from that.
Ian, listening to what Tim's saying about, computer trading and 24-hour news, and then looking at the stock prices over the several days given the coronavirus headlines, does that make you feel like the market's getting extra vulnerable to these unpredictable shocks and reacting badly?
No, not necessarily. I think it's more of a function of the, the market's done very, very well, as everyone's aware, over the last several months and even beyond that. So I think when markets are trading at what we think are fair value levels, then the stock becomes, or the market becomes a little bit more reactionary just to day-to-day news because it doesn't have anything more meaningful to trade off of. We saw that last year as markets were heading higher. It seemed that every little news item tied to our negotiations around China trade would move the market up or down day by day. And we're seeing that in the same way with the coronavirus. So I think it's just the market digesting things as they always do.
Tim, you know, looking at this relief rally related to coronavirus, do you think there's anything else propping stock prices up in the past several days?
Well, we have gotten some good news out of companies reporting their earnings. About half of them have reported their fourth quarter earnings so far, and I've been very pleased to see the earnings that they're reporting on the bottom line, their sales growth, and also the 2020 guidance they're giving us, and that's been just a catalyst for moving stock prices higher. I'm also seeing evidence of really good capital allocation out of publicly traded companies. And I'm also seeing that because of this coronavirus, the Federal Reserve and the Bank of China and others have stepped up and said they're going to provide liquidity if the situation in China, you know, spreads and impacts more supply chains. And also, I think we're getting a little bit of election relief. We're getting a little more clarity as to how the primaries are coursing through, and we're getting a little bit more clarity on some of the proposals of the candidates that might get legs, you know, in the fall.
Well, Ian, Tim just reflected a little bit on the corporate earnings that have started coming out. Does that mean recession fears have died down?
Yeah, I would say absolutely they have. And really what brought recession talk to the fore starting in late 2018, early 2019, was the movement lower in global interest rates. Now, once the Fed then lowered rates three times last year, that largely solved most of the concerns tied to interest rates that, frankly, were really feeding a lot of those recession worries.
Well, but, you know, last year we spent a lot of time worrying about negative bond yields, and those still exist in Europe and Japan. You know, the 10-year Treasury here in the U.S. dropped from about 1.8 to 1.5 over the last few weeks here at the beginning of the year. Are we worried about decline in interest rates like this?
No, I wouldn't say we're worried about another decline in rates, but we do see it as more likely than rates increasing anytime soon. You know, in fact, we think we're actually very well positioned if interest rates go lower again, because we think the biggest beneficiaries will once again be stockholders if rates go lower. You know, rates have moved lower and the yield curve has flattened out once again, though. That is a point worth making. We've yet to see the 2 and the 10-year Treasury yields invert like they did briefly in 2019, but we're certainly closer to that than we were just a few months ago. And if that occurs, I think that'll create some worry in the market. But if the Fed just does what they did last year, we expect them to come in and once again lower rates to sort of fix that inversion in the yield curve, which I think would cause markets to then move higher.
Okay. So, Tim, you know, we read last week that the federal budget deficit came in at a little more than $1 trillion over the previous 12-month period. There doesn't appear to be any signs that the deficit's going to contract anytime soon. How is federal spending impacting interest rates and economic growth? And are you guys joining the chorus of people who say that deficits don't matter?
Well, I would first agree that the deficit is not going to contract. It's only going to get larger. You just run the numbers. And the only way we're ever going to run a surplus again, or I don't think we're going to, you know, run a surplus again. The only way we're can ever contract that deficit is if we ever got to the point where we can run a surplus. And I go back to 2016 when the Congressional Budget Office was starting to put out projections that our deficit would, in fact, start hitting $1 trillion per year starting around 2019, 2020, no matter the situation of our economy and no matter who was in office by 2020. It's because there's a lot of promises been made for discretionary defense spending and future promises made for Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, et cetera. So that's the situation we're going to be dealing with. Is it impacting interest rates? Well, it should, and the textbooks have been telling us for 50 years it should, but it hasn't. And the chief reason it hasn't is because of what's been happening overseas. We've been having very stagnating, sluggish growth out of Japan and Europe for almost a decade now, and as a result, their bond yields have plunged to zero or below, and that has made our debt look very, very attractive to an international investor. Why buy their debt that yields nothing when you can buy our debt yielding 2% and money plows in to buy our bonds and pushes down our yields, so it gives our government free pass, really, to issue more debt and finance deficit spending at very low rates. Now, I would also argue, I think part of that question dealt with economic growth, that these deficits in some form are stimulus. you know, we got to consider them something that, like the Federal Reserve's doing, it injects money into the economy because most of that $1 trillion of deficit is the result of payrolls, of paying people like firefighters and teachers and folks in the military and folks who work in hospitals and doctors who get paid through Medicare and such. So there is a positive impact of running these deficits. Now, does that mean that they don't matter anymore? Absolutely not. We're always concerned when, you know, deficits are growing and there isn't an ability long-term to finance them. But right now we just don't see a catalyst for this resolving itself. We see other entities around the world in much more serious debt situations than we are. And I'm referring to places like Japan and China, Italy, France, and even here in the United States, Illinois, say Chicago, New Jersey, Connecticut. I think they're going to go through debt-related problems much more quickly and you know, than the United States is, and we'll have to see how investors react to those first.
Ian, so we're looking at, you know, stock markets at new highs, interest rates continue to be low. How are you changing the way you're putting portfolios together in light of those issues?
Well, in regards to lower rates, we're not really tweaking our approach much related to that. If anything, we're spending a little bit more money on some of our favorite value-oriented dividend-paying companies, just great stodgy businesses that grow slower but that pay higher levels of dividends to stockholders. Dividend payers have largely underperformed their growth counterparts over the last few years, so there's some good value in that space. And also, just on the back of lower rates, those dividend payments become that much more attractive on a relative basis. So if anything, it's just a slight tweak towards those sorts of investments when we're making our purchases, but not in a really significant way.
Okay. So, Tim, you know, 3 months ago, 6 months ago, 9 months ago, trade issues and tariffs were all the news. We've seen some progress recently on talks with Mexico and China. Has the market stopped worrying about trade, and are these deals going to be good for the U.S. and the economy?
Well, I would say that the trade worries have basically shifted in recent weeks. Because we've had some resolve with Mexico and with China, that those types of worries have gone to the backdrop, and now they've been replaced by worries about the coronavirus and the spread there and the fact that it's just causing new supply chain problems, you know, starting with China and its own trading partners. The tariffs were causing a slowdown in certain countries and in pockets of industries here in the United States. There's no doubt about that. Tariff is a tax, and anytime you tax an activity, you get less of it. But as we look through the agreement with Mexico, that looks to be a net positive for our economy. And I had a chance to read the agreement that we signed with China a few weeks ago. And that's, to me, is going to be a long-term net positive because it's going to help U.S. businesses who have been complaining for 20 years that their intellectual property has been, and their ideas have been stolen. And the Chinese have undercut them in prices and built similar products and threw factories up and you know, just took away their market share, you know, very quickly. And those types of things we hope are going to be a thing of the past. And as I said, this should be a net positive for us.
Okay. So in the past couple of weeks, guys, you've both been involved in our 2020 Economic Outlook presentations. Tim, can you give us a quick summary on what you see happening the stock prices that came through your forecast for this year and why?
Well, when we gave the forecast a few weeks ago, we said that we saw the same conditions prevalent starting this year as we saw a year ago. We saw an economy that was capable of growing 2 to 2.5%, you know, on an annualized basis. We see corporate earnings still growing at positive rates this year. We see continued low interest rates. We're also in an election year, and that tends to bode well for promises of further spending in Washington going forward. The only difference between now and a year ago is that at the start of 2019, we're coming off of a contraction or a 20% correction in the stock market. So we started 2019 with cheaper valuations. We thought the market had no place to go but up, and we were forecasting that the market was capable of rallying at least 10 to 15% just to get back up to fair value in 2019, and it did. Going into 2020, we don't have the undervaluation situation. We're more at fair value, which means stock prices are going to have to earn their keep this year. And we still see an economic backdrop that says share prices can appreciate.
So, Ian, you also made some points in those presentations about the upcoming presidential election and the historical effects on the stock market elections have. You know, you care to step into the mud and elaborate on those thoughts?
Sure. Yeah, we did touch on that at our annual Outlook events, just given that it's an election year. So we did wanted to just look at the history behind election years, politics, and markets, and we thought the data was interesting, which is why we shared it. And really the summary is political party affiliation, economic growth, and market performance are not really highly correlated at all over time. The one theme that we saw play out again in the data is that the market prefers incumbency, which is another way of saying the markets really don't like uncertainty. And that's not a political statement. That's just a statement regarding the data over time. And we also just wanted to remind people, you know, sometimes I think we make the mistake of overemphasizing politics when we make our investment decisions. And there are just many more things, more important things to consider, such as, you know, what are the fundamental characteristics of the asset classes and the investments that you're looking to invest in? What are the valuation levels across those instruments? What's the underlying economic landscape look like? What are your own long-term goals for your own wealth and money? Those are all considerably more important than who's in office in any one year.
Well, Tim, that all sounds optimistic, but, you know, the market does seem concerned about a few of the campaign proposals, you know, rescinding parts of the 2017 tax bill, raising tax rates again, Medicare for all. You know, how are you adapting portfolios, if at all, to this rhetoric?
Well, I think we are going to adapt only if and when the rules and the laws actually change in Washington. And those changes that, you know, that maybe have gotten investors worried right now are just rhetoric at this point. It is way too premature, you know, even though it's 2020, it's way too premature to try to handicap what may or may not get passed. And as Ian just pointed out, if there is a state of incumbency after November and we have a situation where Republicans still control the Senate and Democrats control the House, that's almost a guarantee that nothing controversial or major is going to get passed from 2020 to 2024. And I think the market's already starting to sense that. If there's anything that we're going to keep a keen eye on, those are the things that can impact stock prices the most. If there is a rollover or rescinding of corporate tax breaks that occurred in 2017, if the corporate tax rate goes back up, if individual tax rates go back up, if the estate tax exemptions come down, those are types of things where, you know, it may paint a target on the backs of many of our clients and investors in general. We'll be looking out and seeing how we have to adapt at that point.
Okay. Well, Ian, you know, stock prices looking back over 2019 were up 30%. They've risen almost 10% just since our last quarterly call. Are you surprised by, you know, the amount of strength in the market? Does it concern you? And is valuation an issue now?
No, I don't think valuation is much of an issue. I mean, if we think back to what really drove markets in 2019, we think a large part of that increase was the result of valuation levels really collapsing at the latter half of 2018. So we thought stocks sold off way too much in 2018. It seemed reasonable that in 2019 some of that was going to return to a normal average, and that did occur. So we really got in 2019 just good, solid earnings results throughout the year. You couple that with lower rates, it certainly makes sense why markets are now trading at, let's call it 19 to 20 times forward earnings, which from a valuation perspective is not egregious. I think Tim earlier characterized it as sort of fair value. I think that's reasonable to say that the market's not cheap, but it's also not ridiculously frothy at this point. It's frankly, we've been trading at around 19 to 20 times forward earnings for the last several years. So it's a long way of saying that there's still money to be made in the stock market as long as you own the right things and the companies continue to post good results.
Well, Tim, we're seeing, you know, new highs in the different indexes, but how broad is this market? Is everything rallying as strongly as the S&P 500?
Oh, no, it's not. This has been a very top-heavy market for probably the last 14 months, and that can be both good and worrisome. It's worrisome because it kind of distorts your view of valuation, and we always like to see broad-based participation, knowing that all the industries and a lot of the companies are participating in economic growth and participating in a market rally. But it's good in that not everything hits its high at the same time. And this market, frankly, this year has been led by a small group of very large tech companies that have been
supporting and been supported by very strong earnings. I think Apple is up another 11% this year after being up something like 85% last year. Amazon and Google are up about 14 or 15% this year. Microsoft's, I think, 18%. Intel and Home Depot are up about 12%. Those six or seven companies by themselves explain the entire S&P 500's rally this year, and all the rest of the S&P 500 companies are pretty much flat. In fact, the average stock right now is about 8% off its high, and that gives us pause and a little bit of enthusiasm to think that, you know, maybe the market seems to be at an all-time high, but there's a lot of stocks that aren't, and we're always looking to see if there's some pockets of profitability or valuation we can exploit.
Well, Tim, do you feel like, you know, with just the smaller handful of very techie types of stocks leading the market rally, is this kind of a sign of an end-of-cycle growth rally?
Time will tell on that one, West. I mean, the movement of asset classes we've seen the past year kind of reveals that the market has, you know, been teetering between believing that we're at the end of an economic cycle and believing that the economy may trip into recession. Normally, when you're getting toward the end of an economic cycle, growth is getting harder to come by. More and more money flocks into the fewer and fewer companies that are hitting their growth and sales estimates, and that's what we've been seeing. At the same time, when we get fears of recession, then money stops flowing into those growth companies, the tech stocks, and they go into the defensive names, which also had quite a good year in 2019. Time will tell, but I think we're on top of how the market is sensing the economy right now.
Okay. So we're going to move a little bit more towards corporate earnings now. And to get started, can either one of you please explain Tesla's stock price to me?
In short, the answer would be no, West. But I'll give it a shot. They did have a great last quarter earnings announcement where they exceeded expectations on a number of important fronts. But you know, Tesla's entered silly territory in terms of stock price movement. It's up, I think, over 250% in the last 3 to 6 months at this point, being driven totally by speculation at this point. It's really the sort of company that we can't get our arms around and we could ever justify buying at this price. They've just never, frankly, had the underlying company fundamentals we typically like to see in a business. And when you see a stock chart that looks like Tesla's, that story usually doesn't end well for investors. We could be wrong. I mean, the speculators may end up being right, but history tells us that it's probably going to be a pretty bad ending for people that have purchased the stock in the recent past.
Well, Tim, most companies have reported December quarter earnings. You know, what were the themes that you saw in those reports? Are industries firing on all of their cylinders? Which ones are the winners and which ones are the losers?
I think one of the general themes is that there's a cautious optimism among executives right now. They're optimistic because they have an undercurrent of economic growth behind them. They have low interest rates, but at the same time, they've been cautious about the tariffs and the trade wars. They've been cautious about the political scene. They're now cautious about the coronavirus. But when I look at their bottom line results, they've been beating earnings estimates. I think two-thirds to three-fourths of companies that we look closely at beat their earnings estimates in the fourth quarter. I'm seeing evidence that sales growth is reaccelerating for a lot of companies, where once growth had been about 10% year over year on the sales front, it hit a drop to about 4% going into the middle or the fall of last year, and now it's starting to reaccelerate again. That's a positive. You add buybacks and dividend increases on top of that, and those are really good cylinders on which these companies can fire.
Okay. Well, I mean, we're still marketed highs, interest rates low. Do you find any asset classes or specific sectors that look really attractive to you now?
Well, Ian and I would be the first to tell you that equities, particularly U.S. equities, still offer the best risk-adjusted returns among all the asset classes, and that's why we've been favoring that for, you know, 3-4 years now, and especially if GDP growth can maintain in that 2-2.5% rate and if interest rates stay low. We would still like equities and just everything else, you're taking on a little bit more risk than we would like to, you know, be offered at this moment.
Okay. Ian, where do you stand on bonds and income investments now? Are you using more bonds or less in portfolios?
We're really using bonds to mitigate risk and volatility in a portfolio, and that's more or less important to some clients than others. It's, you know, historically bonds are used to fulfill income needs at a portfolio. That's obviously been difficult with interest rates being so low. Over the past few years, we thought, over the past 5 years, we thought as interest rates moved higher, hey, maybe we can start using bonds to actually produce some income in client accounts, and then rates went right back to where they were years ago. So, again, it's really an asset class that we use as a proxy for cash. It's an area that you can invest in to get a slightly higher yield than cash, but beyond that, it's just in a portfolio to really take some risk off the table.
Well, are you looking to, you know, kind of stretch into some of the higher yielding sectors of, you know, lower rated corporate bonds or overseas, you know, real estate investment trust, preferreds, pipeline companies? You know, are you finding that the risks are higher the more yield you're chasing?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a relationship between how high a yield is and the risk that is incorporated in that investment. So within bonds, we try to not take additional risk in the bond market. We feel like we have enough risk in the portfolio just given our equity exposure. So when we do place bonds in an account, we're trying to just get that modest amount of income and stability through time. I will say that, you know, we've been willing to own some high-yield corporate bonds, particularly wrapped inside a fund or an ETF where the risk is mitigated. Preferred stocks offer a nice attractive yield without taking too much risk. But beyond that, we try to keep the bond side of things pretty squeaky clean from a risk perspective.
Sure. Well, do you think the Fed's going to raise rates at all this year?
No, we don't. They came out, I think, at their last meeting and said that they expected rates to stay pretty much where they are. I've noticed lately that the futures market is saying that it's actually more likely that they end up lowering rates again this year. We certainly do not see an environment in which they would want to raise rates this year.
Okay. Well, Tim, this is going to be our last comments on the economy. You know, what do you see are the pluses? What are the minuses right now?
I'm going to sound like a broken record because I could probably recite these from memory, but our labor markets are very strong. Unemployment at a 50-year low. Household spending isn't good shape. Household debt levels are in excellent shape right now. Bank balance sheets are in excellent shape, and they are in position to keep lending and injecting more liquidity into our economy. Certainly, low interest rates is making it more possible to expand this economy. So those are all very strong pluses, and they override the few negatives I see out there. And all those negatives are related to trade fears more than anything, or companies that are exporting. Multinational companies, manufacturing companies that are exporting into Europe and Japan and China aren't doing as well as we'd like them to. Railroad and shipping companies are complaining about the impact of the tariff wars. Farming industry, same story there. Auto industry, same story. I think energy markets have been reeling under just declining oil and gas prices recently. But those industries as a whole are just a smaller percentage of economic activity as they were 20 and 30 years ago. So the vast majority of our economy is functioning the way we want it to.
Okay. So we're approaching the end of the call. There's always some questions about some individual stocks. This is going to be our lightning round of individual stocks. I may give you a comment or two and then name the stock and get your thoughts back. So, Tim, I'm going to start with you. Big surge in price last year. Do you still like it? If not, what do you like better? Apple Computer.
We still like Apple, but obviously after an 85% rally last year and more this year, we can't like it as much, and we're not an active buyer of it. We do like Microsoft. We do like Amazon. We do like Accenture in the IT space. We still think there's room for growth for all of them, but come on, an 80% gain in 1 year, it's Apple has borrowed its gains from the future, no doubt about that.
Okay. So next stocks had some negative headlines in the past year. Ian. Johnson & Johnson.
Yeah, sure. They've been in the news, obviously related to their talc powder litigation, and then more recently the opioid crisis, which has really affected anybody in the pharmaceutical industry. And the stock price took a little bit of a hit, particularly last year. It got down, I think, into the 120s at one point before rebounding much higher to today's levels. And we've been a long-term fan of Johnson & Johnson for a number of years, and we thought those issues were minimal related to its overall business, so we're happy we stuck in there with it.
Okay. So credit card issuers, MasterCard and Visa. Tim?
I like their credit trends that are underlying their business right now, both here in the United States and in Europe. We're seeing sales growth and credit purchases growing at 10 to 14, 15% annual rates, and that's been translated into 10 to 15% sales growth and 20% earnings growth for both these companies. They're also buying back a lot of stock because of the excess cash flow they have. We love these companies. We think they're perfect, beautiful substitutes for owning traditional banks, which we used to have in portfolios a decade ago, but now we see that we'd rather prosper from owning the companies that process the transactions and collect a little fee. So we still like them.
Okay. A last stock we want to talk about is for Ian, and that is Ulta Cosmetics.
Yeah, Ulta, I think it was a couple quarters ago, had a pretty disappointing earnings announcement on some slower growth out of the makeup segment, but that has since rebounded, and their last quarter was much more positive. They're one of the few retail companies that we think has good growth prospects into the future. They still continue to take market share, so we're still a happy buyer of Ulta these days.
Okay. Thanks, Ian and Tim. I appreciate your comments. This concludes the Trust Company's quarterly investment call. If we weren't able to address your question today, we welcome your call to keep the conversation going. The Naples Trust Company and Tampa Bay Trust Company are divisions of the Sanibel Captiva Trust Company. Thank you again for joining us, and have a great afternoon.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.